How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Well, it's becoming a tradition now, and we love to do it. And since the Grizzlies and the Thunder are playing, it's time for our co-produced, co-promoted, co-hosted Locked On Grizzlies and Locked On Thunder. I am Peter Edmiston, and joined by the host of Locked On Thunder, Fred Katz. And Fred, these are two teams going in two completely different directions at this point, making for a very interesting matchup.
Yeah, so the Grizzlies are what? They're one game up on the Thunder right now in the sixth seed?
One and a half, I think. I got to double check on that, but I think they're one and a half up on the Thunder.
We come prepared for this stuff.
this is first class stuff. Now I'm pretty sure it's one and a half. So yeah.
Well,
Let's just look it up right now. Yeah, one and a half.
The beauty of the internet. Yeah. So Memphis is 30-21. Thunder at 28-22.
Yep.
Thunder have lost three in a row right now. You know, they are coming off maybe might have been the worst that they've played all year against Chicago. They were really bad. They lost that one by 28, 128.
You got to tell me real fast. I didn't get a chance to watch much of that game. How do you lose to Chicago by 28?
It was bad.
At home, no
less. It was bad. I mean, look, losing that game, if you play well and you lose that game because it's the second night of a back-to-back and they were in San Antonio the night before, so like, yeah, it's a home game, but you're still traveling between and all that stuff. It's not completely inexcusable if you lose that game by four or something and you put up a valiant effort, right? But, you know, your legs are tired and your jump shots aren't going in, whatever it is. That wasn't the case. They were awful. They weren't getting back in transition. They were giving up layup after layup. Chicago shot 15 out of 20 in the third quarter alone. They just got crushed in the third quarter. They gave up 39 points to the worst shooting team in the NBA in the third quarter. They were not good. It was pretty much a blowout all the way through. And I mean, even early in the game when it wasn't quite, they weren't quite getting rocked. You didn't know it was going to end in a 28-point game. Like, they were not playing well. It was completely sloppy.
Well, I notice as I look over the Thunder and doing my, I think it's fair to say unparalleled prep work for this particular podcast. The Thunder have kind of fallen off a cliff defensively of late, and in no great shakes on the offensive side either. Over the last 10, the three-point shooting plummeted to under 30%, under 42% from the field, minus 10 net rating in that time. And I realize that, you know, Enes Kanter punched a chair at some point in that mix, and that was a whole thing. But you know, what's happened here? Because this is a team that does not look especially good.
I mean, look, part of it is that they played a lot of road games. Part of it is that they've played a lot of really good opponents. I mean, they played in Utah. They beat Utah, but Utah's a really good team. That's tough. They lost in Cleveland. They lost in San Antonio. I mean, these aren't, you know, games where you're just going to walk over teams. You know, these are tough opponents that they have to go up against. And they weren't going to win in Cleveland. They lost by double digits. And they weren't going to win in San Antonio, even though I actually thought they played a pretty decent game, given they were missing Kanter and they were missing Alex Abrines. I thought they were okay, but you're not going to win in San Antonio if you're the Thunder. It's just probably not going to happen, especially when you're undermanned. And losing Kanter has really hurt them. So, like, when Russell Westbrook is off the floor, the common narrative is that the Thunder offense is really bad and they're unable to score. Statistically, that hasn't been true. Over the last 6 weeks or so, when Kanter has just been great over the last 6 weeks before he got hurt, the Thunder had a 110 offensive rating with Russell Westbrook off but Kanter on. And it's because they were running everything through Kanter. In 44 minutes now since Russell Westbrook, and I just tweeted this, in 44 minutes now, in the three games without Kanter, with Westbrook off, they have a 72.9 offensive rating.
That
is going to hurt you. That's not great. That is like unimaginably bad. Like, to put that in perspective, like, Philadelphia is last in the NBA in offensive rating, and theirs is 99.8. So the worst offense in the entire league is averaging 27 points per 100 possessions more than the Thunder are with Westbrook and Kanter off over the last three games.
Well, I noticed there's no lineup. There's no on-off. Nobody's good in the last little bit. Steven Adams, I guess, might just barely qualify as good. But in terms of pure net rating on court, everyone is at least a minus three over the last 10 games. And Russell Westbrook's minus 10 on the court. I mean, you can go up and down the list. There's very little to speak of in a positive fashion for this team. And, I don't know, is it a fatigue thing is Westbrook? I mean, he's dipped under 40% shooting the ball, in the last month or so. Is it just too much for the guy?
No, I don't think it's necessarily a fatigue thing. Like Russ, they lost these last two games. Russ wasn't the reason they lost to Chicago. He wasn't, he was fine. And I actually thought he played quite well in the, the San Antonio game. So I don't think that was necessarily the problem. There are other issues. I mean, look, there's the defensive issues. There's the fact that they give up a lot of shots around the rim too. Like, they give up a lot of shots in general around the rim, so teams are prone to getting hot against them too, and that's something as well.
If you're gonna give up shots around the rim, then you're gonna have problems. And it's interesting to see the comparison of these two teams basically since they last met. The Grizzlies, and I've just got a piece up for the Commercial Appeal that you can read online today or tomorrow in print. But it's about the offense for the Grizzlies. The Grizzlies' offense is unbelievable. I don't know how much you've had a chance to watch the Grizzlies of late, Fred, but the last game against the Thunder in Oklahoma City was probably their worst offensive game over the last month or so, and they've completely changed around. They're eighth in the NBA since 2017 in offensive rating. They are second in the last couple of weeks only to Golden State. They have hit. This is a crazy stat. This year, in their last 22 games, they've hit 10 or more threes 16 times, which prior to this year, it took them 271 games to hit 10 or more threes 16 times. It's a completely different situation. They've had double-digit threes 25 out of 51 games this year. In Marc Gasol's entire career leading up to this point, all the way back to 08, the team only had 23. The identity has completely flipped around. Now, they've lost a little bit on the defensive end because of that. And I think it's kind of a calibration kind of thing. But Mike Conley's playing unbelievably well right now. And I think he's taken the all-star snub personally because I don't remember him playing this well. He and Marc Gasol both just got finished with their best scoring months of their career. January of 2017, both of them had their highest scoring numbers in that month, and Mike Conley had his second highest assist numbers in that month on top of that. The last two games they played, and admittedly they were bad opponents, Phoenix and Denver, although Denver's playing well, but Denver didn't have Jokic, didn't have Will Barton. Jameer Nelson got ejected 4 minutes into the game, which is fun. You take that into consideration, but they never blow anybody out, and they blew both of them out and played really solid defense in addition to really good offense. So I don't know. I'm not going to say they've totally turned the corner or anything like that, but they finally seem to have taken what they like to do, which is to still play slowly. They don't like to move with a lot of pace. They're still, 29th in pace, but they've bumped up the shooting and the efficiency tremendously on each possession. So they've managed to really squeeze it out while still playing at their pace. It's been interesting to watch.
So correct me if I'm wrong. Over this street, and that tweet about, or that fun fact about 10 or more threes and 16, getting to 16 games with that and taking it 271 before these last 22 is just unbelievable.
It's crazy.
That is a crazy, crazy stat. Now, to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like one of the bigger deals, like, or as big of a deal, the fact that they're making threes, is that they're creating a lot more threes over this stretch too. So what have they been able to do, at least differently or more effectively or whatever it is, that's allowed them to create so many more threes?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the first part of it is that, you know, they have personnel and they have lineups now that they consistently play that are all shooting lineups, you know, pretty much. And you know, that Zach Randolph has been outstanding off the bench, and even he, you know, now shoots a little more frequently from the 3-point line, but they really park him with those bench units and let him do all his post work with those groupings. So he's able to get after it. He's got a really high usage rate off the bench. You know, they focus in on that when he's on the floor, but otherwise all their units out there are all, you know, 4 out or even 5 out with Marc Gasol. And they've been killing the Conley-Gasol pick and roll. They've averaged 1.5 points per possession through this road trip on every Conley-Gasol pick and roll. They're shooting 60% from all the offense that's generated from that pick and roll. And, you know, because those guys, Conley's finally healthy. You know, he's turning the corner. He couldn't turn the corner for a while. Even when you last saw them, both Thunder games, he was still hurt. The back was still bothering him. He couldn't really turn the corner. So that pick and roll wasn't as effective because he just didn't have the explosiveness to drive in. Well, he's got that back. So, you know, his ability to drive now has to be respected. That forces closeouts and that forces help. And then he dishes it to, you know, whoever happens to be open. That's why his assist numbers are so high. Then they can pick and pop with Gasol either mid-range or out to the 3-point line. And he's been hitting, you know, on this road trip, those two guys combined are shooting 52% from three. You know, they've hit 26 threes in 4 games between them. You know, they just have a multiplicity of weapons in that grouping. So everyone else that's out there, like, you know, whether it's Chandler Parsons, who isn't really, you know, doing much, or James Ennis, or even Tony Allen to some extent, whatever they have to do on offense, whatever they specialize in is really limited, but it can be limited because, you know, those two guys, on the starting unit and Zach Randolph on the bench unit are the stuff they're running really emphasizes their strengths. I think it's been a nice job offensively by David Fizdale of play calling and by those guys of really identifying what it is they want to do. And I think that's really, to me, that's where the difference is.
Yeah. You want to hear a fun fact now?
I love fun facts.
So the Thunder, for the most part, until recently, they were really hovering around the middle of the pack in offense. And Memphis was really, like, early in the year, they were 28, 29, something like that.
First month they were 29th in offense.
Right. And right now Memphis is actually a 10th of a hundred of a point per 100 possessions ahead of the Thunder in the offensive rating. Memphis is 20th and the Thunder are now down to 21st, 104 to 103.9.
Yeah. Crazy, right?
It's interesting. When you look at the Thunder, like, they have a negative net rating now. They're 6 over .500, and they've lost 3 in a row. They were 28-19. They're now 28-22. But the net rating is now negative. It's down to negative 0.8. And the thing with the Grizzlies was often that they were – we talked about this last podcast, them outplaying their net rating, right? But the Thunders and the Grizzlies still have a little bit. They've improved their net rating since the last time that we talked. And they're still doing it a little bit. But the Thunder are outplaying their net rating maybe probably more than any other team in the league right now.
Yeah, I would say they'd have to be, you know, because if it's not the Grizzlies, then it's the Thunder. And if it's happening like it's happened for the Grizzlies, I mean, it's those games like you saw, on Wednesday when the Thunder, you know, got their brains beat in, you know, that the Grizzlies always mix in, you know, a handful of those every year to kind of skew some of the totals, to skew the Pythagorean, to skew all that. They like to mess with it like that. They just don't have it, and they don't even, you know, really try to keep it close in those games. They don't mind. Last year, the Grizzlies got beaten by 50 by Golden State, 30 by Cleveland. You know, those two, minus 80 alone messes with your Pythagorean forever. It's very difficult to dig your way out of that hole. And in terms of net rating, it's similar. Yeah, that's where both these teams, you know, they have really high highs, but they've also got the potential for really low lows. What I'm curious about is, we've seen Zach Randolph in his role change with the Grizzlies, and he's really, in the last 6 weeks or so, you know, he had dealt with the death of his mom, and when he came back, he wasn't mentally healthy, just wasn't there. He's starting to get back to himself, and you can really see on the floor, he's got that look in his eye again. But he plays for the Grizzlies the role that Cantor plays so well for the Thunder. Cantor does it with a little more, grace, I guess. He's a little better passer, a little more elegant player. Zach's really more of a bulldozer in there. But it's similar. You know, big guy comes in, a lot of offense, a lot of scoring, hitting the glass, getting after it, facilitating on that bench unit. So without Cantor, because I can imagine what the Grizzlies bench unit would look like without Zach, and it could get pretty ugly. What does the Thunder do bench-wise without Cantor?
You know, Billy Donovan has just been experimenting with everything on this. So I think the best example that we've seen so far of how just Billy is just kind of throwing stuff at the wall and trying to see if anything sticks was really in that Chicago game during the second and third quarter, especially in the end of the second quarter. So the first time they played Chicago, the Thunder won by 15, and that was in Chicago. Jimmy Butler was sick, so obviously that result was a little bit skewed because Jimmy Butler is, you know, a top 10, top 12 player, whatever he is. And he didn't even score, or he didn't have a basket in that game. I think he finished with 1 point. But the Thunder used Cantor Adams lineups a lot in that game. Both those guys went for 20. One went for 22, one went for 20. I forget which was which, but Cantor had a 20-10 game that night, played a bunch of minutes. The two of them played together. The Thunder were up 20-something points in the fourth quarter. It was a total blowout. This time, Billy used Andre Roberson as a four in the second quarter to try to close out the second. And he went to Domantas Sabonis with about a minute left in the quarter. And it's not the first time we've seen Roberson play the four. You know, he did that in the playoffs a decent amount against Golden State last year, and he's done it very sparsely during the regular season this year, but just kind of shows how he's grasping it at not just straws, but anything that you could put in the drink to try to just get a sip of whatever the heck is in there. You know, like he is just trying to get whatever he can out of this lineup. He's an experimental guy. He wants to put out lineups to see what works, to create some sort of sample size, not necessarily to study the numbers, because 2 minutes of lineup data means absolutely nothing, as you very well know, but just to more see how it looks. And as he says very adamantly, like, he's not just putting stuff out there for the pure sake of experimenting. He's doing stuff because he thinks it's the best case in that scenario. But I do think Billy's philosophy is to create as many different lineup combinations as he can and see if he can find anything that works in a scenario like this, because it's not just Cantor out, it's also Alex Abrines. So they have a couple of guys who are normally unfamiliar with getting minutes, whether it's Kyle Singler, whether it's Anthony Morrow, whether it's, you know, Andre Roberson having to slide over to the four, or, you know, him going with three guard lineups with Cameron Payne and Russell Westbrook and Oladipo, or you know, Morrow with one of those guys, or whatever it is. He's trying out new stuff. And I don't know if maybe he ends up going that small route because he thinks, well, maybe he doesn't love playing Joffre LeVern at the four because he's kind of more of a five. Maybe that's what he ends up doing. Maybe he ends up going a little bit smaller. Maybe he ends up playing bigger because LeVern has a good rebounding game. I think with Billy, like, he's still trying to figure this stuff out. And what's interesting about the Chicago and Memphis games coming consecutively is that, like, those are two teams where the Cantor Adams lineups really worked. So we're going to start to see right away exactly how he's going to play this stuff in situations where Enes Kanter would have gotten a bunch of minutes.
Yeah, it's such a challenge, and it's one that David Fizdale's had to deal with the Grizzlies. You know, how do you replace key guys? How do you replace those minutes? How do you find combinations that work? You know, and yeah, you're right. I mean, lineup data, you know, you can only get so much from 2 or 3 minutes, but it's all you have in a season. I mean, you can't practice much in a regular season. You might get, a handful of practices per couple months, maybe. I mean, where you can really go at it, because otherwise you're resting or you're between games. You got two, you know, all these injuries, whatever it may be. You just don't get a chance to do much. So you have to at least look at it a little bit on the floor to figure out what you're going to do. You have to get creative with stuff. You have to try new things. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Do you think is Billy Donovan doing a good job with the challenge that he's faced so far?
I think he's doing a fine job. I think he's the one thing about Billy. I mean, we can talk about the lineup combinations and that kind of stuff. And I don't know if there's any coach who could lose. I mean, Enes Kanter is the sixth man, and he's probably at least the fourth most important player, fifth most important player on this team. And he's the sixth man, and he's not the sixth man of the year, but he's a guy who will receive votes for Sixth Man of the Year. Someone will give him votes. Someone will put him on the ballot because he's having a really, really good offensive season. And I'm not sure any coach will be able to just kind of figure that out in a three-game span. The thing that I think Billy does a good job with, he is one of the most even-keel people I have ever met in my entire life. It is amazing. So I grew up a Yankee fan watching Joe Torre. And I was always like, Joe Torre is exactly the same. He doesn't smile when they win the World Series. He doesn't smile when they lose by 11. It doesn't make a difference. And Billy Donovan is very similar in that sense. And I think when you have a loss and you have some roster instability and that kind of stuff, that's an important trait to be able to have just to maintain an even keel in the locker room. So far, I think that's something that can really help them.
Well, that is important. That's huge. And I like his demeanor. I mean, he's done a lot. I think he got a little bit of a bad rap early on. I think it took him a little while to adjust to the NBA his first year,
he admitted that.
He fully admitted that. Yeah, you could tell.
He was very open about it. Like that wasn't a secret. Like I did not think he did a great job for a lot of the regular season last year and kind of turned around in the playoffs and was like, oh, okay. Like he's a good coach. He's definitely a good coach. Now, granted, I wasn't covering them in the regular season last year and didn't see him up close, so I obviously had a different perspective and that kind of stuff. But he readily admitted, I think it was in like February last year, where he talked about like there was an adjustment. He had to realize that the college game and the NBA game are very different games and they're coached like totally different sports. And I think he's gotten to, I'm not saying this, everyone is progressing and learning, as he will tell you, but he's obviously more comfortable now than he was around this time last year.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Fred, like as covering a team and really like being there on the ground, and I think it helps to kind of be covering a team on a regular basis to learn some of this stuff. But I mean, especially in the NBA, coaching is it's sort of like you're a boss at a nice like little small company. You see your employees on a day-to-day basis, but you don't need to micromanage them. They have their own little departments and they're doing their own stuff, and you need to kind of oversee the general direction of the company, and you need to put out any fires that may come up, but you don't have to do every little detail. I mean, these guys that are out there, speaking from a Grizzlies perspective, David Fizdale kind of had to, he's learning when to back off and when to push. And most of the stuff that they're running is stuff that Mike Conley's calling out there. Fizdale's not calling all these plays. I mean, they'll write, he'll draw stuff up out of a timeout or something. But by and large, they've gone over the sets they like, the matchups they like. Here's the things that they want to exploit. But it's up to you guys to go and do it. And in college, there's much more micromanagement. There's much more, this is exactly what we're going to do. Bing, 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 bing. Let's call the timeout. Let's get this. Let's get that. Let's get this. These are less mature kids, 18 to 21. You're still figuring out what you're doing in life. All that stuff. These are adults now. They got families. They got other stuff. They're not worried about all this nonsense. And coaches, sometimes it's hard for them, especially college coaches that come in, or even sometimes assistants that move up. Mark Ivoroni was a Grizzlies coach back in 07 for a year and a half or so, and he never got that. He was a super smart guy. He was 50 when he took the job, had been one of the highest touted assistants for years. Oh, this guy's going to be he's got head coach written all over him. Oh, he's brilliant, et cetera, et cetera. And he came into the job, and he was so smart that he couldn't communicate with the players, because he just would speak right over their heads, or not even to them, would talk around them, wouldn't take their needs into consideration, and players just like, screw you, and they turn you off. And I think it's a credit to Billy that he knew those limitations, he learned on the job, he kind of adjusted to that sort of thing, and dealing with some difficult personalities and some very strong alpha guys last year with Russell and Durant and all that whole thing throughout the year. I mean, that was not an easy situation that he found himself in. So I gained a lot of respect for his ability to kind of adjust on the fly, because I don't know very many college coaches that could drop themselves into that kind of a situation and learn so quickly.
I'll take your point one step further too, which is that, you talk about the on-court effect. There's the off-court effect too, which is when you're in college, you get into a town and you take the team to the hotel, and then you have a team dinner to make sure what they're doing that night. And then a lot of times coaches have curfew checks and make sure guys are in their room. And then you have, you know, a team session, whether it's a film session or a breakfast or whatever it is, you have that in the morning. And like, it's so much more independent in the NBA. And that's another thing in terms of college coaches. It's one thing to be, you know, kind of a guy who wants to maintain control on the court and inside those 48 game minutes. Like, no one would say that Tom Thibodeau is not a good coach because he wants to maintain control during those 48 minutes. And he's a guy who really works his players hard and during practice and all that stuff. But Tom Thibodeau is not forcing guys to do team mandated activities when they're on the road. You know, it's a different kind of lifestyle too. And I think that's something that some college coaches, which Billy is not, and I think that's something that some college coaches end up struggling to adapt to too, is just giving people, treating people not necessarily like college players to NBA players, but college students to just grown adults. And I think that's something that's a transition for a lot of people, because you think of a coach as, you know, you think of a coach as like a role model when you're a college coach. You got to be a role model of those guys. And that's not the case when you're coaching 34-year-old Nick Collison. It's a very different scenario.
Well, and particularly, and it's true for, you know, David Fizdale. I think the adjustment for him, you know, coming from the Heat, and, you know, he dealt with strong personalities there under Eric Spoelstra's system. But, you know, you come into this locker room, this is a Grizzly team that has a core that's been together probably longer than any other core in the NBA, with Conley, Gasol, you know, Tony Allen, Zach Randolph. You know, they've all been together for 8 years, basically. So, you know, you're the coach, you step in, but these guys all, they run the show. So you gotta adjust to them, you know, and he came in and he put Zach Randolph on the bench, and he made a lot of tough calls. And, you know, there've been times when there's been some friction there, but I think he's, for the most part, done a good job. And now I think you're starting to see the fruit that's coming from all of the difficulty that they've been going through and all the, you know, the ups and downs. They've been remarkably inconsistent for, like, I don't know, 6 weeks or so. They just haven't been able to get anything going. They've had injuries. They've had all this other stuff. You know, they still have problems with Chandler Parsons, who doesn't look anything like a max player or even like a mid-level player at this point. But that's, they're getting by in that situation. I want to give a word to Mike Conley as well, because I mentioned that he's, I think he feels like he was snubbed, and I don't know that he was, but he feels that way, and he's playing so well right now. In you know, you watch him in the last few games, and you're seeing like what he can do now, finally unleashed, and you see it in spurts, but it's starting to kind of come together as a more of a full package over the course of the last few games. He's one of the few guys. And this is what makes their attack interesting. He's one of the few guys. There are only three players. Maybe you can, I can give you a little mini quiz here. Okay, I was writing today about this for the commercial appeal, and so I did a digging in through all the synergy numbers, and there are only three players. So a minimum 50 possessions. So at least you got to at least have a decent number of possessions by this point in the season. Minimum 50. Only three players are in the top 25 in points per possession, both for shots off the dribble and catch and shoot.
Ooh, shots off the dribble. Kevin Durant.
Nope.
Stephen Curry.
Nope.
Oh, man. Kyle Lowry.
See, now Lowry's close, but not quite. And I'm surprised. A lot of these guys, you're in the right ballpark, although these are – Mike Conley is obviously one of them.
Yes,
or else I wouldn't have said that. That would be weird that I would have brought that up.
let's go, Isaiah Thomas.
Okay, that now you see the style is right. But these are not. These are more prominent guys than actually. We're looking at more role players.
Gotcha.
The other two. There's one of them that is a bench score extraordinaire for a bad team, and one of them is a highly touted.
Lou Williams.
Yep, Lou Williams. Very good. And one of them is a highly touted extreme specialist who has had a little bit of a destabilizing effect.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I Danny Green?
Ooh, this just gentleman has been on the move in the last month.
Kyle Korver.
Kyle Korver. So Lou Williams, Kyle Korver and Mike Conley are the only three in the top 25 in efficiency, both for shots off the dribble and for catch and shoot. And considering the different roles, I mean, those guys are much more specialists. Lou Williams is just go out there and just have fun. And Korver is extremely like, you know, just here, you know, let LeBron do stuff and then you do your thing. It's a testament to his offense that has really taken off this year. And, you know, now that he's starting to combine it with the defensive effectiveness, he looks like an all-star. When you watch him play, he looks like an all-star out there of late. I don't know if he can keep it up. You know, he always manages to pick up a few little injuries and, you know, stuff seems to happen to Mike Conley. But everyone, every opposing broadcaster, every opposing fan, they love to rake him over the coals for the contract. $153 million, highest paid player. It's Mike Conley. Oh my God. It's everything. When you watch him play, he looks like that guy now.
Let me ask you a question.
Yep.
All right. So all-star rosters have not been determined yet in this scenario.
Okay.
The Western Conference is down to two people for the final spot. And they call up you, Peter Edmiston.
Okay.
And they say, we need you to decide the final spot. It is between DeAndre Jordan and Mike Conley for that second wild card. Who are you choosing?
I mean, that is so hard, man, because there's such a different thing, you know.
But that's the position that the coaches were in, so that's
it
why.
Is. No, I mean that's why fair I because you. It's a wild card. It's a wild card, so it's fair. I mean, it's a fair question. I probably 2 weeks ago I would have picked DeAndre Jordan, but given what the last couple weeks with Mike Conley, maybe you can go back 3 weeks, has shown me that his issue was injury related to me more. His poor performance, especially on defense, was more injury related than anything else. And so I'm going to give him a little bit of a pass on two or three of those weeks where he kind of underperformed, because he was really good early in the season. Then he went out with a broken back. He came back in 2.5 weeks from a back fracture, which was probably a little bit early. And so he didn't really perform up to snuff. And kind of, you know, booted around a little bit for 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, I thought maybe that was the level, but he's really bumped up his game. So I think he has to do more, and I think he's asked to do more. And I think he's more of a two-way player right now. So I would edge it to Conley, but it's no knock on DeAndre Jordan. It's no knock on, you know, any of the other guys. It's close. It's really, really close.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredibly close. And both of those guys were kind of always the same guy. Like, Conley and DeAndre Jordan are the two guys who, as of, you know, 2 weeks ago, they were the two guys who had the argument of the two best players in the NBA who had never been All-Stars. Like, it was right. Those two. Now it's just Conley, obviously, because DeAndre Jordan made it. But DeAndre Jordan went so backwards, though. You realize he was first-team All-NBA, then he was an Olympian. Then he was an all-star.
it was weird. And I think, and I'll ask you this, Fred, because I tweeted this out at the time that Conley was not picked. I think it's entirely possible that Conley ends up with more fame and notoriety for never having been an all-star than for being an all-star once.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, you know, I never thought about that, but you're probably right, because everybody brings him up as the best player who's never been.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's on every broadcast.
No one's going to say like Devin Mike
Harris was an
all star
once. Yeah. You know, Devin Harris was an all star. Jamal McGlure was an all star. Like, yeah. I mean, nobody.
Amir Nelson.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, do people think of them as all stars? No. I mean, they don't. You know, that doesn't really. It doesn't. One all star appearance does not dramatically alter your career trajectory and perception. Whatever that may be, it's nice to have, and I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm sure Conley would rather have the all-star appearance than the, you know, fame of never having gotten it. But I just think effectively, it's probably not better, but it will be good in its own way, never to have gotten it.
I think that's a great point. I'm sure he would disagree with you.
Oh, he does.
But I think that's a great point, and I'm totally in on that.
I wonder if we'll see now tonight, as these teams play, if the Grizzlies win, the Clippers have been just, booting it around a little bit, up and down, decent, okay, but, certainly vulnerable without Chris Paul, even though they got Blake back. The Jazz, I never know what to make of the Jazz. The Jazz are capable of very impressive performances and very bizarrely bad performances. I mean, on the whole, they're a very good team, but they match up, the Grizzlies in particular match up really well with them. It's kind of a perfect fit when they face off. They really seem to neutralize the Jazz especially well. And so in this matchup, we talked about it last time, and I think everything's pretty much the same. You've got the Warriors starting to pull away from everybody else. Spurs have been really good, but kind of just flying as much under the radar as a, almost 800 winning percentage team can do. The Rockets are, hitting a little bit of a slide of late, but they're still clearly in third spot, no doubt about it. Has anything changed for you watching this? I think you and I both had the Grizzlies in seventh last time we talked, but when all was said and done. Has it changed for you? Because I honestly think the Grizzlies have every chance to jump up to fourth the way they're playing, especially because their schedule is about to even out a little bit.
Yeah, I think they have a chance to jump to four. I still think they're going to end up at six, just because Utah, when they're healthy, Utah's 31-19 right now, but when they're healthy, they're much better than a 31-19 team. And they're healthier now than they've been on average this season. So I think they're better than like that 31-19 is, that 620 team that they are right now. I think they're more talented than that. I do think at this point that Memphis is going to finish ahead of the Thunder, just because Thunder are missing Cantor for an extended period of time, and they're already ahead of them. And Memphis is playing a lot better lately. So I do think they're a team that could get up into the high 40s, maybe even the low 50s. But I don't know if they're necessarily going to pass by Utah. And as for the Clippers, when is Chris Paul supposed to come back?
I don't know. I have to look it up again.
They've got a tough stretch in the schedule right now. They have a bunch of road games. And I think their one home game was that Warriors one in this stretch that they're in. So they're in a tough, tough stretch right now where they have a bunch of road games. So that could knock them down a peg. But I still think, like, the Clippers have this habit of, for the last, like, 15 or 20 games of the season, when they eventually get healthy, they go on a run at the end of the year and somehow get into 55 wins or close to it or whatever it is. And if Chris Paul does end up coming back in the time frame he's supposed to, I think it's supposed to be, like, by the end of February, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be just a little after All-Star break, and he's back on the court doing stuff. So he's kind of eyeing it. He's been... he tends to try to come back a little early, and then he picks up little nagging injuries here and there.
Right,
he's got a little bit like Mike Conley in that regard.
Yeah.
So, I don't know that you can count it, but if he's not back for, the majority of their games left, I mean, they without him, they're a totally different team.
No, absolutely.
And a horrible team.
No, there's no question they're a totally different team. But if he comes back with a month and a half left, that's a month and a half of him and Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan and JJ Redick and, parentheses, Carmelo Anthony.
There's no way they're doing that deal.
There's no way the Knicks are doing that deal, you mean?
No chance. You cannot.
I don't know why in the world the Knicks would do that deal.
Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford, that's pretty much it.
Look, Rivers gets too much flack. He's like a pretty useful player.
No, I like Austin Rivers. He's fine. He killed the Grizzlies last time the Clippers played him.
Yeah, but there's no way the Knicks could do that. There's just no way the Knicks could do that deal.
No, just out of pure principle, you're like, come on, I got to get a pick. I got to something. Come on, you're killing me.
Yeah, that would be a disaster.
I get the whole cap relief thing, and it allows you to rebuild, and it sort of indirectly helps you because it makes you worse and makes sure your pick is as good as it can be. And that's all fine. But the optics of it, I'm telling you, go to the Grizzlies and go back to the Pau Gasol trade that they made with the Lakers that ended up netting them Marc Gasol and gave the Grizzlies cap room that they used to trade into for Zach Randolph. They absorbed Zach Randolph's big salary in that deal. They traded him for Quentin Richardson, and they got Zach Randolph because they could absorb the salary. But still, what's the perception of that trade? Even now, the perception of that Pau Gasol to the Lakers trade is, oh my God, the Lakers just completely obliterated the Grizzlies. It was embarrassing. You had Greg Popovich calling for a trade committee after that thing was done. Like, you can't have a trade like that. You can't do this. We got incompetent owners. You had it was riots in the NBA streets, and that's turned out to be in the very long run a great deal for the Grizzlies, and maybe that would turn out in the very long run to be a great deal for the Knicks. But I promise you, the perception, just like the perception of that Pau Gasol trade, still stains the Grizzlies to some extent, even though in the long run they were probably right. It would do the same thing for the Knicks and for Phil Jackson by extension. Not that his reputation's already in the mud anyway. I don't know what worse you could do, but that wouldn't help.
If they're turning to, it's so easy to turn to Knick bashing, isn't it?
It's fun. It's easy and fun. Bulls bashing, although you can't do that. There's a lot of teams that are Cleveland, the whole thing with LeBron and Barkley. Yeah, you can turn into all that. This is why the NBA is great, because there are these.
You just realized with our last four topics now, we've covered the banana boat four. We went from Chris Paul's injury to the Melo trade to now you just mentioned Cleveland with Dwayne Wade drama and then LeBron's drama. So we are going full. We just hit for a banana boat cycle.
And, you know, I mean, it's all banana boat, and, you know, we've talked about Fizdale, and we've talked in Cleveland. They're having a former Grizzly tryout with former Grizzly reject tryout with Lance Stephenson and Mario Chalmers and Jordan Farmar among those. So it's all connected. You know, everything's connected.
I loved it. I love Chris Haynes. I think he's really good at his job. He's a good reporter. He's a good writer. He's a good beat reporter. Everything along those lines. But did you see the tweet when he reported that?
No, I didn't see it.
He reported it as Cleveland will host a, quote, mega free agent workout. And I saw that and I just started laughing. A mega free agent workout, and he reported it with Lance Stephenson, Kirk Heinrich, and Mario Chalmers. I was like, mega free agent workout.
The mega. That's a
Kirk Heinrich, mega free agent Kirk Heinrich is looking for a team.
Mega free agent Lance Stephenson, who the Grizzlies had a $9.4 million option on this season. And there were lots of fans here who wanted them to pick that up. And they obviously didn't. He ended up signing a minimum deal with New Orleans and getting cut due to other injuries and other problems, his own injury and everything else that's happened 3 weeks into the season. But, I mean, I want to tell you, Fred, there was a legitimate plurality of Grizzly fans that wanted them to pick up that $9.4 million on Lance Stephenson, who is now part of the mega free agent bonanza, the bachelor in Cleveland who can impress LeBron.
You don't get to become a mega free agent by people not wanting you. That's not the way this works.
No. God help you if you went to the mini free agent workout. I can't even imagine who would have been.
The mini free agent workout is just like me and my brother playing one-on-one. That's it.
All right, Fred. Good stuff. I look forward to reading what you will write for the Norman Transcript about this one and hearing what you have to say on Locked on Thunder. Folks can follow you, Grizzly fans, especially for tonight's matchup. You can follow Fred, if you don't already, at Fred Katz, K-A-T-Z. Very easy. You can follow me at Peter Edmiston, Thunder fans, if you want to do that. You know, you can do that. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
I'll endorse it.
I appreciate that. Thank you. That's very kind of you, Fred. and in the meantime, thanks everybody for joining us here on Locked on Grizzlies and Locked on Thunder. We'll talk to you again soon.
Hotline.
Hi, my family's going to a tailgate and I want our style to stand out from the crowd.
Just go to Old Navy.
Old Navy?
Yep, Old Navy's got all the latest fall styles. Plus, during Old Navy's colossal sale, you'll save up to 50% off store-wide.
Did you say up to 50% off?
I did, so don't sit on the sidelines. Old Navy has the perfect pants from $19, stylish dresses from $15, and comfy tees for the family from just $6 right now at Old Navy and oldnavy.com.
We're cheering for Old Navy.
High fashion, Old Navy.
Valid 10-2 to 10-10. Select styles only.